So thank you very much for the invitation to talk. So I should entertain you while you have lunch on nonlinear supersymmetry. And okay, these are the topics that I'm going to cover. We'll start with some motivations and introduction, and then essentially discuss two parts. One is n equal one nonlinear supersymmetry. And some applications at the end to standard model or to MSSM. And the second part is applied in extended supersymmetry, in other words, one linear plus one nonlinear, that is more related to brain dynamics. So the main consequence of nonlinear supersymmetry is that there is a Goldstone fermion, the Goldstone, that was introduced by Volkov Akulov. And the question is why to study the Goldstone interactions. There are two main reasons. The first is that we can describe effective field theory of supersymmetry breaking when this happens at low energies. In other words, in the limit where the Goldstone mass is much lower than the supersymmetric breaking scale, such as in models of where the Gates mediation is dominant compared to gravity mediation. Obviously, in reality, the Goldstone is part of the gravitino, plays the role of the longitudinal component. But of course, in this kinematic regime, the other two components of the gravitino are interacting very weakly with the Planck scale, suppressed, while the longitudinal component, which is the Goldstone, interacts with only is enhanced because the relevant scale is the supersymmetric breaking scale. So that is the kinematic regime that. Parameter so that I will discuss light Goldstone compared to soft breaking scale, so soft masses in the standard model, and much and lower than the breaking of supersymmetry. The other motivation, the other application has to do with dynamics of brains. And there we know that half of the supersymmetry of the in the presence of a brain. Half of the supersymmetries of the bulk are broken, but of course these are not broken explicitly. They are really realized nonlinearly on the brain, and this nonlinear realization of the additional supersymmetry actually strongly constrains the couplings of the brain to bulk fields or to brain fields themselves. This nonlinear supersymmetry is exact, of course, in the large volume limit, but in practice, for instance, in type 2B commutations with orientifolds, is broken explicitly by the orientifold projection at finite volume, but still can be used in order to determine locally the interactions of the brain. And of course, it becomes most important for compactifications of large volume. So I will start with describing the nonlinear supersymmetry. So this is a transformation of the Goldstone. It transforms with a constant. Xi is the supersymmetry parameter, and K is the Goldstone decay constant, which has dimensions of mass to the minus 2. So it's essentially directly related to the supersymmetry breaking scale, plus a linear, of course, term. But this linear term is like a translation with a parameter which is a vector which contains the Goldstone itself. That's why it's nonlinear. So chi is the Goldstone. I will use the symbol in the following. And xi is the parameter, supersymmetry, transformation parameter. Now there have been over the years three formulations to study the Goldstone interactions, the self interactions as well, the Goldstone interactions with matter. The first is what is called standard realization. Essentially, is the way that Volkov and Akulov introduced, and then was further expanded by other people. So I will first start with this. And then there are two types of superfield formalisms. One is ordinary superfield in the way that I will explain, and the other is using constrained superfields. It is essentially a way to integrate out heavy degrees of freedom and remain also only with the light ones, which realize the supersymmetry nonlinearly. So I will go through this formulation first, and then I'll describe the continue. So the first is the standard realization. This was the original one, which is geometric. So you introduce a kind of a metric, which is the flat metric deformed by essentially the energy momentum tensor of the Goldstino. Actually, more precisely, this is not a metric, but it's the square root of a metric. So it's like a field bind. And you see it immediately from the transformation of the determinant, which transforms with a total derivative. So you can write down immediately an invariant axiom, which is integrated in the determinant of Z. And then this, of course, can be expanded by using the I mean, the fact that lambda, as I said, depends on chi itself. The fact that, of course, chi is fermionic field means that this expansion will terminate at some point, but of course there are many terms, higher derivative terms. Now, this construction can be generalized to matter and Gates fields by simple way, by just multiplying the determinant of Z with any Lagrangian of a scalar field, where the scalar field should transform only homogeneously under the supersymmetry, nonlinear supersymmetry transformations. And therefore, this axiom would also transform homogeneously. Obviously, the problem will arrive here is with derivatives, because if you have a field with transforms homogeneously, take a derivative, will not. So you have to define supersymmetric covariant derivatives, and this and the rule is just to multiply a derivative with a field bind, essentially with this with the inverse metric. The same thing with the field strengths of if you have a field strength of a vector field, you just multiply the indices with an inverse metric. So every time there is an index, you multiply with the inverse matrix, and it becomes covariant under supersymmetric transformations. And therefore, the axiom is determinant of Z times any axiom, polynomial axiom of fields and derivatives which are made covariant by this rule. And you can expand it. So first term is a usual term, and then the first interaction is a universal interaction of Goldstino to matter through its energy momentum tensor. It's energy momentum tensor with energy momentum tensor. And this was the main this was the main result of this interaction. However, it was realized later on that this interaction does not describe the most general invariant axiom under this nonlinear supersymmetric transformations, where matter fields also transform this way. In other words, you can write down terms which are invariant and which cannot be obtained through this method. So this is the reason that this superfield formalism introduced. And as I said, there are two types of superfield formalism. So the first one is relies to the following recipe: for every field, scalar or fermion, whatever. You promote it to a superfield by adding the fermionic coordinates, the usual fermionic coordinates of supersymmetry theta and theta bar, by replacing the space-time positions by x tildes, which are the usual space-time positions translated by this lambda, where lambda was the same vector that was entering here in the transformations by replacing psi with theta with a superspace. Okay, so that's the rule, and of course, it's again, since the relation is nonlinear, you have to do an expansion. So in particular, the Goldstino itself can be promoted to a spin or superfield, which is by applying the same recipe and adding this constant piece. And again, the covariantization of the indices should be done using this metric, which is now depends on these modified positions. So this gives a well-defined rule that you can write, you can take any operator and you can make it invariant, supersymmetric invariant, and then expand it in powers of kappa. And find what are the lowest dimensions. So this is a simple counting to show that if you are interested to find, for instance, the effective operators up to dimension 8, then one needs to concentrate only to restrict to initial dimensions of the initial operators less than 2, and then go to expansion up to second order in kappa. So this can be done in generality, and you can find this list of operators. The first is surprising is that there are actually two operators of dimension 6 which are linear in Goldstino, actually the derivative of Goldstino, and evolve either a field strength of the Gates field and the fermion, or a fermion and the derivative of a scalar. Then there is one operator of dimension 7, which contains two scalars and two Goldstinos with derivatives, and the five operators of dimension 8, which are listed here. The first two are just four fermions, so it contains two Goldstinos with derivatives and two fermions, just contracted in two different ways. And then you can replace the fermions by scalars and derivatives or Gates fields and so on. Okay, so this is a complete list. Now let me go to the other formulation, which is using constrained superfields. This was also introduced in the past. This was the original by Rotzek and Zetlin, and then it was revived more recently by Komagorsky and Seibel. And I'm going to use also this their formula for later on. So it actually is an elegant way to recover the same couplings of the Goldstino to matter. So the main observation here is that even if supersymmetry is broken spontaneously, and therefore there is no strictly speaking supercharge that you can define, still there is a conserved supercurrent, and this means that although superpartinels do not exist in as single particle states, still they exist in operator space by using the conserved supercurrent. So it means that you can introduce constrained superfields which eliminate the superpartners in terms of the light degrees of freedom, which obviously is they will appear in a polynomial in a nonlinear way, and these would be the partners, if you want, of the light degrees of freedom. For instance, if we start with a Goldstino, the partner of the Goldstino, let's say the Goldstino belongs to some chiral multiplet, the scalar partner has been integrated out from the initial theory because supersymmetry is broken. But it is replaced by Goldstino bilinear, for instance, or functions of Goldstino bilinear. And one can show that one can introduce a chiral superfield where the Goldstino belongs, satisfying the constraint x squared equals 0. So this constraint can be solved explicitly. So the lowest component is quadratic in the Goldstino, and then the fermionic component is the Goldstino, and then you have the auxiliary field, the F auxiliary field. And as usually, this chiral superfield depends on the chiral coordinates y. It takes also this more simpler form, which is just an F term times modified theta, which is translated by the Goldstino field. So the recipes you take, this F is auxiliary, so you must, when you write an action, you must solve it by the equations of motion. So for instance, if you write the lowest dimensional action, is the usual canonical kinetic term, xx bar, it's a d term, plus an f term, plus solid, yeah, ordinary linear term in the superfield. Because any other function will be zero, since x squared is zero. No? So that's the most general action that you can write down. And then you can solve for f, for the auxiliary field, put it back, you find the Volkov-Akulov action. So that's one way to determine it. And this F, the auxiliary field, starts with 1 over kappa, which is the Goldstino decay constant. So this method actually can be generalized to find Goldstino couplings to matter by introducing constraints in superfields. Actually, there are two kinematic regimes that you can one can have. The first is a kinematic regime in which the energies are bigger, considered bigger than the, or of the order of soft supersymmetry breaking terms, and still less than the supersymmetry breaking scale. In other words, you can have, you can imagine a situation in which the Goldstino is very light, but still you have, you look at TV energies where the, all other particles have superpartners. So in that case, you can couple the Goldstino to MSSM. And the recipe is to just replace the Spyrian superfield, that it is auxiliary, in order to recover the soft terms, by the Goldstino superfield itself. Okay?
I have a question.
Yes.
What do you mean by M soft? I mean, usually M soft defines the splitting between the partners.
Right.
Now you don't have a partner because it's nonlinear area.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Now you are in an energy regime in which the matter fields have supersymmetric partners, and only the Goldstino does not. So the Goldstino is light.
But matter fields have
partners. So you can couple the Goldstino to ordinary superfields of linear supersymmetry. This coupling can be done very easily by just replacing the Spurian that you use usually to find the empirical practice of the soft terms by the Goldstino superfield itself. The Goldstino superfield, as I just saw before, depends on the auxiliary field. So you must solve for the auxiliary fields and find the interactions of the Goldstino to matter to ordinary MSSM, but this will be nonlinear, of course, we have many terms. So this is one regime that I will use later on for phenomenology. Another regime is extremely low energy. I mean, extreme. Okay, low energy compared to M soft. In which case, nobody has superpartners, so the superpartners are integrated out. And then, in this way, we must introduce additional constraint superfields for matter. In other words, you take every matter superfield, since it's part of it became heavy. You must introduce additional constraints for those superfields. So, for instance, okay, this is a list that you can do. You start with fermions. So, fermions have superpartners which are this quark and leptons. These scalar quarks and leptons are heavy, so you must impose a constraint to which is expresses the fact that have been integrated out. And this constraint is just that the fermions belong to superfields that satisfy this constraint, q times x equal to 0, where x is a Goldstino superfield itself. So this can be solved, and that's the expression for Q. I mean, for every... So psi is the fermion, every fermion of the standard model, the quark and the leptons, no? And chi is the Goldstino. So this solves automatically the constraint, because if you want in these variables, capital theta, the Goldstein superfield was just theta squared. So it just automatically satisfies this constraint. Similarly, one can ask the question to do the same thing to keep complex scalars and integrate out the fermions. So this is what you want to do for the Higgs. If the Higgsino is heavy and you want to live with the Higgs, then the constraint there is that the Higgs should belong to a multiplet, which satisfies the constraint that x times h bar is chiral. So the covariant derivative is zero. And this gives you, this is a solution, so you obtain a solution that the Higgs superfield is actually the Higgs itself evaluated at the coordinate y. Actually, this is the only case in which the solution that you obtain from this way coincides with the superfield formalism that I introduced before. So if it goes back, yeah. Coincides with X, with this recipe. But all, in the all other cases, no. Okay, I can ask also the question, if for instance you have two scalars, let's say if the theory has additional axioms, for instance, that belong to superfields, and you want to keep only the real part, all the imaginary part, of and the other part of the scalar to be massive together with the fermion. Then one has to impose an additional constraint, which is equivalent, which is this one, that the same product is chiral, but you determine what is this chiral. It's x times a itself. So a is the superfield, the constraint superfield in which an axion lies, and okay, that's the expression. And finally, you can do the same thing for vectors, so for Gates fields. Okay, at Gates fields, of course, there is a subtlety of Gates transformation, so you must find also a convenient Gates choice that is compatible with Vesumino Gates, sorry, that can replace, that should replace the Vesumino Gates, and this is a convenient Gates choice that the Goldstein times the vector superfield should be zero, and then you can eliminate the Gatesinus from the integrate out again and live with Gates fields by introducing this constraint, which is the same actually with this constraint for fermions. You just replace the chiral superfield by the field strength superfield, which is chiral. And you can solve the expression for the vector superfield. So this contains a vector and has bilinear of Goldsteinus in it. Okay, so that's the recipe. Of course, this does not by this way introduce fields, but I didn't write the Lagrangian. So then we must start employing, use these constraint superfields and write the Lagrangians. I mean, normally this method should give the same results as the other, I would say, but nobody has done this exercise. So now let me go to the relation with brains. As I mentioned in the beginning, a brain breaks half of the supersymmetry since we want to go to n equal 1. So we'll consider type 2, let's say, strings compactified on an internal manifold that breaks. Like a Calabi-Yau manifold that breaks n equal 8 to n equal 2 in the bulk. And the presence of the brain breaks half of it, realized in a nonlinear way. So that's precisely a single half, single stack of brains spontaneously breaks half of one of these supersymmetries. And effectively, I will consider always a four-dimensional effective field theory, so the extra dimensions of the brains will be wrapped appropriately in cycles of the Calabi-Yau. So in this case, the Gates group is UN generically, and I will call QE the remaining supersymmetry, and QO the one that it is nonlinear realized. Now the broken supersymmetry obviously commutes with a gauge group, so the Goldstino is automatically has to be the U1 gauge Zeno of with respect to the linear supersymmetry. So UN contains a U1 factor, the gauge Zeno of U1 under the linear supersymmetry. It transforms also nonlinear under the second supersymmetry. I will come back to this extended n equal to 1 linear plus 1 linear later on. For the moment, I want to go all the way to n equal 1, so break the linear supersymmetry. For that, one possibility is to use one framework is to use intersecting brains, which is also useful for model building. So we know, okay, in intersection of two brains, you have by fundamental matter on their intersections, which are chiral fermions generically. So the intersection generally breaks all of the supersymmetries. However, for special intersection angles, one of them is preserved, and well, for instance, the sum of the angles is zero in factorized tori. And those that are broken are non-linearly realized. So you have too many non-linear supersymmetries, and the Goldstinos, if you want, correspond to U1 cross U1 Goldstinos. Now, for special angles where one you have an additional linear supersymmetry, then there is only one combination of these Goldstinos. Of this gauge Zeno, it becomes a Goldstino because the other one is part of a linear multiple. So this actually, I will have to talk about special angles if you want to discuss scalars, because in brain intersections, the only way to have light scalars is to go at angles where you have massless scalars, and therefore you will have presence of one additional supersymmetry, of course locally on an intersection. Now I could imagine to do other constructions, just it didn't go. But I had to go manually. Sometimes it works. For instance, so I can try to could do different constructions, which from the beginning they break all of the supersymmetry, and you are the linear one, and you sort of, you just left over with the nonlinear by combining appropriately orientifolds and brains. For instance, take by convention, the D brain has Lamora Mozart's plus. And positive tension anti D brain has minus with positive tension, and this is an orientiful which opposite charges and tension for the brain, an anti orientiful opposite charges and tensions from the anti brain. D brain preserves one supersymmetry linear and one nonlinear. The anti D brain is the other way around. And the orientiful preserves the same linear supersymmetry with the brain, but breaks the nonlinear explicitly. And the anti-orientiful the other way around. So you can construct the following model. If I take a brain with the orientiful, then obviously, if you put on top of the other, then the nonlinear supersymmetry is completely broken by the orientiful, and you are left all with the linear. But if you take an anti-D brain and you put it on top of the orientiful, then what happens is that the linear supersymmetry of the anti-D brain is broken explicitly, while the nonlinear one is preserved by the orientiful. So you have explicitly nonlinear supersymmetry by default, by construction. And one such example gives a gauge group SO2N when you take N brains. With fermions, however, which transform in the symmetric representation of the orthogonal group. Symmetric representation has a trace part, which is reducible, and this trace part contains a Goldstino. It's identical to the Goldstino. The reason for this is that the identical anti-symmetrizes, the boson symmetrizes the fermions if you put them in this way. So that's another example that one can consider, but I will not discuss this. I will discuss only the intersections. And then finally is the third model to plane the, to take the brains away from the orientifold that I will discuss also at the end, in which you just focus on the brain wall volume, in which you have partial breaking of supersymmetry from n equal to n equal 1. In other words, you have one linear and one nonlinear. Now it works. Okay, the other comment I mentioned already. So one can make as a toy example an application of what I mentioned before. Consider the intersecting brains. So you consider the matter from the intersections. You choose the intersection so that you can have massless scalars, and then you find what is a Goldstino. And you determine which are the effective operators which give you the couplings of the Goldstino to the various matter fields. So that's a simple exercise that you can do. First of all, you find that the Goldstino decay constant is given by the sum of the brain tensions, inverse, 1 over kappa squared, T1 plus T2. And then you can compute the Goldstino couplings, and you find an explicit and a quite simple result. I mean, out of this list that I mentioned before of of operators up to dimension 8 that you have out of this all these operators of dimension 8, the only non-vanishing couplings are the first two, which contain the dimension 6 operators, plus one coupling here of the 4 fermion. All the other couplings are zero. Of course, you have reducible diagrams. In other words, you think that they may you may form them by reducible combinations. But the irreducible ones are just three couplings. And also, these couplings are extremely simple. In other words, they don't depend on the intersection angle. They're just given by numbers in terms of the string tension, or if you want, the Goldstino decay constant. So these are the coefficients. So these are the two coefficients of dimension 6 operators, and these are coefficients of the 4 fermion. And as I said, these are universal and dependent on brain angles. I don't know what is the reason for this. And moreover, these dimension 6 operators, which are linear of the Goldstino, can be written in the following way. J mu times d mu chi, so chi is the Goldstino, and J mu is the supercurrent, the n equal 1 supercurrent of the linear supersymmetry that is locally preserved on the intersection that, in order to have massless scalars. Okay, so that's the result. But of course, this is not, n equal 1 supersymmetry does not exist in the full theorem. So I open parenthesis now to make a phenomenological analysis in the standard model. So suppose that you have the standard model with a light Goldstino. You take only the standard model fields, and you want to see what are the consequences of having a light Goldstino. Then obviously, the out of these operators, you take only the dimension 6, which are the most important ones, and try to identify what are the fields that can enter, that enter there with standard model fields. So the first one contains the field strength of a gauge field, so it has to be the hypercharge, because it has to be gauge singlet, U1, plus a fermion singlet, which does not exist in a standard model, unless if you introduce a right-hand neutrino first. So this is not quite interesting. However, the second operator seems more interesting, because it contains a scalar, which can be identified with a Higgs, and a fermion, which can be identified with a lepton doublet. I mean, that's the only way to make Gates invariant. Now, an operator, of course, which couples the Goldstino with a Higgs and a lepton number, would be apparently would violate the lepton number, and therefore it would be subject to constraints on the coefficient. However, this constraint can be avoided if you associated a lepton number to a Goldstino, and I can convince easily by simple constructions that this is possible to do using brain models. So it's not something that we cannot that is improbable. So by associating a lepton number to the Goldstino, you evade the constraints from lepton number violation, and then you can see that this interaction introduces decays of the Z and the Higgs. The Z because it's a longitudinal part of the doublet, not that part of the, I mean, the Z through its longitudinal component. That can decay into neutrino Goldstino or W into lepton Goldstino. So the decays of Z's and W's can be used in order to constrain the supersymmetry breaking scale if you want the Goldstino decay constant, and then examine what are the signal, which is an invisible decay width for the Higgs. So the bounds that you find from the, which essentially come from the invisible Z width on the supersymmetry breaking scale is about 500 GeV. So I use here a parameter. You see, this E2 actually was determined in string theory would be 2. Okay, but if you want to make a model independent analysis, you can take consider the parameter, take of order 1. So you define this scale M, which is of order Suzy scale over 2. Using this bound, one can then examine what is the invisible Higgs decay, and the result is that it can be dominant or at least non-negligible in a large region of the parameter space that involves the supersymmetry breaking scale and the Higgs mass. So you have seen these pictures before. So these are the partial decay width of the Higgs. And the green curve is the invisible decay of the Goldstino. So here I fixed the supersymmetry breaking scale 600 GeV. You see that, okay, this is the function of the Higgs mass. So for Higgs masses which are below 150 GeV, the invisible decay is dominant. Or in this curve, I fix the mass of the Higgs to be 115, so okay, low. And then the visible decay dominates the BB bar below, for supersymmetry, below 1 TV, let's say. Okay. M is half of the supersymmetry base. So that's one thing, one possible. A consequence, the other is to go to MSSM and couple the Goldstino to MSSM. This is an exercise that you can do. There is a paper that preparation that should go out soon. You can find what are the most. Just remind you that what you do here is you take the MSSM, you couple to the Goldstino constraint superfield, you solve for the auxiliary field, you find the interactions, and then you see what are the consequences. So the main consequences have to do with the Higgs. Reason is that the Higgs potential is modified by an additional term, which is this one. It's proportional to the kappa square. And it's a quartic term destroys the flat direction of the quartic potential H1 equal H2. I mean the D term flat direction. So M here are the soft breaking parameters, B mu, and mu is the Higgsian mass. Now the interesting result is that using this extra term, which modifies the quartic coupling, it is easy to see that one can increase the bound on the light Higgs mass, and the value of the light Higgs mass above the left bound, already without taking into account radiative corrections. One way to see it is that in the large tangent beta, you can expand, you can do the minimization and expand the mass, because otherwise the formulas are complicated. And you obtained a correction, positive correction, that of course is down by supersymmetry breaking scale, but involves a new parameter. So if you take numbers of this type, so supersymmetry breaking scale to TV, mu 900 ZV, then you obtain, you are in the Pichel-Lebb bound. But okay, of course you can play with this, and then there will be also some radiative corrections, which even if you don't fine-tune, there will be there. But for the moment, these are just the three-level values. So here is, for instance, yeah, how you see how the mass of the Higgs depends on the supersymmetry breaking scale by fixing mu, this high value, 900 GeV, take large tangent beta, and vary the mass of the pseudoscalar from 90 to 150. Okay. Or this curve, I fixed the value of the, pseudoscalar to be 150, and vary the mu from 400 to 1000. Okay, and this now again is a function of the supersymmetry breaking scale. So I see that in the large parameter space, the mass, yes.
Could you explain a bit more how this quartic coupling appears?
How it appears is big.
So for example, in the simple model, if you have some, like what are you integrating out, if you have some diagrammatic interpretation?
I don't know how to, I mean, it must be some way to obtain it, but you must, you must introduce, let's say, a superfield in which breaks the supersymmetry, because the Goldstino is in that superfield. In the absence of electroweak symmetry breaking, the Goldstino is in that superfield, but the scalar, scalar partners become heavy, and
that's a way. From loops that have the Goldstino inside, or
no, it has nothing to do with the loop. Okay. I don't think it's a three level. It's three level.
Yes. Why was that not considered previously? You haven't changed the concept.
Because nobody studied this coupling before.
I mean, just.
I mean, people, if you want, that studied the consequences of light. Of light gravitinos from models of gauge mediation. They didn't study the Higgs potential, but they studied some decays, which I will discuss here.
I just mean in the study of the MSSM is just.
Yeah, but nobody did this. I mean, this is a general way to parameterize a low supersymmetry breaking scale. Of course, in order to have this term important, the scale of supersymmetry breaking should be relatively low. Which is also part of the problem. If you have a particular model of gauge mediation, I don't know any model that gives you supersymmetry breaking scale to TV. No? It gives you usually tens of TV, but then this term is suppressed. See, but if you want to do a model independent analysis, you don't know if you could have such a situation. I don't know what is the model, explicit example that can give rise to such. To allow such low values, but in principle, I don't see the reason why you cannot have.
And so there are no assumptions there?
No, here there are no assumptions. It's model independent. Yeah, you take this constraint superfield, the Goldstino superfield, you couple it to MSSM, and you find this extra term. And then you expand it in powers of kappa. And that's the first term. I didn't mention it immediately, but it's obvious that the fact that you have a quartic coupling of the Higgs reduces the alleviates actually the problem of a little fine tuning. And the interesting thing to see is that for large soft masses, this quartic coupling increases, and therefore the fine tuning decreases, which is again. I would say that counterintuitive picture. And finally, there are new couplings that, in principle, that for instance, they could also give rise to invisible Higgs decay. Now the decay of Higgs into two Goldsteiners is too much suppressed, so there's not much to say there. However, if the neutralino, if the lightest neutralino is has a mass which is lowest than the Higgs mass, then you could have a decay of the Higgs into the neutralino into sorry, the neutralino is here, which is the NLSP, into a Goldsteiner into a neutralino, and this could give you again an invisible Higgs decay. That, okay, that is the a plot that gives you the visible Higgs decay. So this is the width directly, not the the partial width, not the not the ratio. I mean, and for pseudoscale 150 GeV, large transient beta, and mu varying from 100 to 1000 going down. So for comparison, this is the decay of the Higgs into 2 gamma in the standard model. So and the reason that I talked before that alleviates the fine tuning is here. So it can become it can become important if if the neutralino is lower than the Higgs.
There's no dark matter category in this approach.
It could be
all the dark matter ones would decay into these light states.
Yeah, we had the discussion, I'm not sure, if there is no candidate. I mean, light, in principle, if you have the gravitino as lowest, so now we're going to switch to the second part, let's say, which is extended supersymmetry. So I will discuss one linear and one nonlinear and the applications to brain dynamics. So once you have a nonlinear once you have a linear supersymmetry in addition to the nonlinear, then the first question to ask is now the Goldsteiner should be in a multiplet of this linear supersymmetry. And then what type of multiplet you can consider? You can consider either vector or chiral. Now, both have been studied, at least up to some level, but the brain dynamics suggests rather that the more interesting case is the the vector case. So I will discuss this, but in principle one can do a similar analysis for the other case. So I will consider therefore the case that it's the Goldsteiner now of the nonlinear supersymmetry belongs to a U1 gauge multiplet, so Maxwell Goldsteiner multiplet with respect to the linear one. So I will start by then one has to will consider general. I will start with n equal to gauge chiral superfield, so the vector superfield, the field strength superfield of n equal 2, which from n equal 1 decomposition of the linear supersymmetry, it contains a vector plus a chiral. Okay, the gauge superfield of the vector field plus an additional scalar chiral. Now the n equal 2 superfield can be expanded in this way. With respect, so you have two coordinates now, two supersymmetric Grassmann variables, theta and theta tilde, with respect to the two supersymmetries, which for the moment I don't, for the moment just take both n equal to linear, and then I will proceed to make one of them nonlinear. So you have n equal to supersymmetry, you have two coordinates, theta and theta tilde, and you expand the gates. Field strength superfield in terms of one of the two coordinates. So the lowest one, the advantage of this method is that you keep one linear supersymmetry explicitly, n equal 1. So you have a chiral plus theta tilde component, which is the field strength of the vector superfield, plus the theta tilde square component, which can be rewritten as a derivative of the chiral. So that's the usual expression. And this expression can be deformed by adding a constant term, which I will call 1 over kappa to kappa for obvious reasons, because this extra term allows for partial supersymmetry breaking. You cannot make partial supersymmetry breaking without deforming the supersymmetry transformation. And that's how this deformation is allowed from the algebra, and introduce an additional parameter that can allow for partial supersymmetry breaking. So by introducing this parameter, then the second supersymmetry transformations, you can be rid of from the superfield. The transformation of the x of the chiral gives a vector, and transformation of the vector gives a constant, okay, which is here. So that's the nonlinear part. But for the moment, it's without constraints, so just a nonlinear part. Now, if you write the Maxwell action, just the linear term, then you obtain the usual n equal 1 Maxwell action plus a chiral superfield, kinetic term, plus a F term of the chiral term. Okay, this is this deformation kappa. Now, this, of course, obviously breaks supersymmetry partially, but in a trivial way. If you want to make to realize partial breaking in a non-trivial way, you must replace this W square by a non-trivial prepotential. In other words, instead of starting with just the kinetic term, you just introduce a prepotential, and then you expand. And you find this is the usual terms, plus this additional contribution, which comes from a deformation, and can be thought as a magnetic phi term, because the derivative of the prepotential is the corresponds to the dual coordinate. And you can add also an ordinary d term, a phi term, for x. Now the scalar potential has this piece. So you can it's positive definite, and if the prepotential is non-trivial, then it has a minimum that breaks supersymmetry partially from n equal 2 to n equal 1 with this condition. But okay, this is not what I want to do. What I want to do now is to impose a constraint that realizes one of the two supersymmetries in a non-linear way. So this constraint is just a generalization of x squared equals 0 for the n equal 1. But now instead of x, you have this W, the field strength superfield of n equal 2, deformed with a second, sorry, go backwards, deformed with this extra term. So if you express this constraint in terms of n equal 1 components, then you obtain the n equal 1 constraint that x squared equals 0. The constraint for the vector superfield that I mentioned before, that x times w equals 0, plus an additional one, which actually this is much stronger than the other two. In other words, sufficient to impose this one. This one implies the other two. This can be solved easily. It was done by Bagger and Galperin. So you can take this constraint and solve the chiral in terms of the vector. So you are left over only with an n equal 1 vector multiplet, which contains the Gates field and the Gates-Zeno, which plays the role of the Goldstein of the second supersymmetry. Then you eliminate the chiral in terms of the vector. You write the action. The only possible action now you can write down by imposing this constraint is this term, which is n equal to a phi term, actually phi Heliopoulos term, and this gives you the DBI action when you substitute the solution. And in addition to this DBI action, you can add an ordinary FI term, which is just n equal 1 FI term, which also is invariant at the n equal 2 supersymmetry. So the general n equal 2 nonlinear action is the supersymmetrization of the DBI plus FI Hellio plus term. Yeah.
Can this be done in the non-abelian case?
No.
So there is no partial breaking from n equals 2 to n equals 1 in
the non-abelian case? For non-abelian, I don't know how to do. There is no, I don't know if it can be done. I mean, I tried, but I cannot. I will describe in a moment the coupling of this to hypermultiples, which is already a non-trivial step, because it's how you can have a charge that the Goldstein multiple can be charged under hypermultiple. But the non-abelian, I don't know.
Where one can start from, say, n equals 2 super QCD, something like that, and spontaneously break to n equals 1, some kind of.
No, no. You need a U1 factor.
That's one question. So, usually this U1 factor, I mean, this, if you have a complete model, mm-hmm. so there's the green Schwarz mechanism.
When you add a hypermultiplet. Mm-hmm. When you add a hypermultiplet. I will discuss this.
Okay.
I mean, without it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
So,
and
so you get
anomalies.
You market anomalies. Get masses for your gauge
fields.
So, does this affect this whole?
Right. For the moment, there is no mass. Okay. But you will. Yeah. That will arrive. Yeah. Yeah. So that's precisely the thing. I'll discuss now the coupling of this Goldstein-Maxwell superfield to a hypermultiplet. The problem is that the hypermultiplets, you know, does not admit off-cell description. So in order to avoid these problems, I will assume that the hypermultiplet has at least one isometry, which is the case, for instance, when a hypermultiplet is charged. And then I will use this isometry to describe the hypermultiplet in terms of a so-called linear multiplet or single tensor multiplet. This has an off-cell description, which I can use in order to couple the hypermultiplet to the vector multiplet. So this single tensor multiplet contains, which I will call Y, n equal 2, contains n equal 1 linear or tensor multiplet, I don't know how to call it, capital L. And a chiral multiplet, usual chiral multiplet n equal 1. So the linear multiplet L satisfies the constraint d squared d bar squared equals 0. And it can be dualized, of course, to a scalar, to a chiral. It's equivalent to have two chiral multiplets, but I describe it in terms one of them in terms of a linear. And this allows to use an off-cell description, which I will use right now. Now, the general action, which has an equal to supersymmetry, depends on L and the chiral multiplet, phi and phi bar, so it's a D term in n equal 1 language. And this function should satisfy the Laplace equation. Okay, this is a constraint for which comes from n equal 2. Now, in order to make the coupling, the idea is to start from this linear multiplet, and this n equal 2 tensor multiplet, and write it in a way that you can couple to the vector that I wrote before. So for this, I want to construct out of this linear multiplet to construct a multiplet that has spinorial index, like W, okay, that I had before. So the idea here is that you write L as D of L, a small L, where L is a chiral spinor superfield, and then you can write down n equal 2 superfield, which has an expansion similar to W that I wrote before. Where is it? Okay, so instead of W, you will have this new chiral spinor superfield that it came out from the linear, and this term. The x is the phi. Sorry, not precisely, sorry. So this plays the role of W. Then the highest component, the square component, is the chiral superfield, which belongs to the n equal 2 vector. And then you have the lowest component, which in which you must introduce an additional superfield which is constrained. So at the end, this superfield is completely constrained, but it turns out that there is it's auxiliary and it contains a form. And you know that from the brains, we have a three-brain discoupled to a form. This is a form that it will appear at the end. So that's the expression, if you want, which is very similar to W. And now you can write down a coupling, which is just a Chen-Simon interaction. This Y times W, then equal to W deform. And then you can expand it, you can write in terms of linear, of the n equal 1 language. But, now this this will use it in a while to define, for instance, the global Susi limit of deep brain coupling to hypermultiples. Now, but before that, let me mention that actually this write down the full action. So the full action is you have the general action of the involving the Maxwell superfield, which just described before, is a DBI action plus a Faye-Leopoldus term. It has a Chen-Simon interaction, and then you can add any action of the single tensor multiplet, which contains this function that should satisfy the Laplace equation that I wrote this here. Now, by actually by finding by adjusting this kinetic term appropriately, you can think of this representation, this coupling, as the Higgs phase of n equal to nonlinear super QED. So you take a super QED, so you have n equal to Gates field coupled to one hypermultiplet. You break the Gates group, you go to the Higgs phase, and then the interaction appears like a Chen-Simon interaction. So this is how this is the interaction that I wrote down. And actually, as it is expected, that this interaction describes actually a Higgs mechanism in which the Gates field becomes massive. So it is like if you have if you realize a super Higgs mechanism without gravity. And the reason is that the Maxwell-Goldstino multiplet is absorbed by the n equal 2 tensor to form a massive vector, so n equal 1 massive vector in terms of the W and L, the linear, while the massless scalar remains. So in this process, the Goldstino is paired with a fermion of the linear multiplet and becomes a Dirac spinor. So the and the Gates field becomes massive. So that's precisely what we know that it happens in the brains. But studying it from this point of view, with effective field theory, it looks peculiar because it's like if you do a super Higgs without gravity, because you give mass to the Goldstino.
How do you set the two-point function for the supercurrent? How do you have to, how do you get the pole in that? If you don't have a massless fermion.
There is a massless fermion, which is the other fermion, not the chiral. But this, is not a Goldstino because it transforms linear. It doesn't have the nonlinear thing. So, and as I just mentioned, this system is identical to the Higgs phase of n equal to QED up to choosing appropriately the action of the single tensor multiplet by doing this change of variables. So you take the chiral multiplet of the n equal 1 chiral multiplet, which belongs inside the n equal 2 tensor. I call it Q1, Q2, where this Q1 and Q2 are the two components of the two chiral components of the hypermultiplet, and the linear multiplet is Q1 square minus Q2 square. So this Q1 and Q2 are the charged hypermultiplets. So you obtain the by doing this chain of variables, you go to the usual basis in which you have a charged hypermultiplet coupled to coupled to this U1 Goldstino multiplet, and then you see that you are allowed to add the mass term. And this mass term is just a linear term in phi. So by adding these mass terms, allows to go to a Coulomb phase if you put the Fourier Leopold term equal to zero. So actually, you can do this study, this general study of the vacuum structure of n equal to nonlinear QD. You have three parameters: the Goldstein decay constant, the Fourier Leopold term, and the mass, which is like a linear term in this pi field. So when the mass equal to zero, then you have a Higgs phase that I described before, like the super Higgs without gravity. When the expectation value of Q1 is real and arbitrary, and Q2 is related like this with Fourier Leopold term. Then you have a Coulomb phase if the mass is different than zero, but the Fourier Leopold term is zero, in which n equal to nonlinear SUSY remains unbroken. And finally, in the generic case, you have both parameters non-zero and the mass and the mass and the Fourier Leopold term. Then the other nonlinear supersymmetry, the other linear supersymmetry is also broken. So you have one nonlinear and the linear which is also broken. So now I would like to discuss to make more connection to the string compactifications and discuss in this context the global limit of the universal hypermultiple. We know that when we compactify type 2B or type 2A on a Calabi-Yau manifold, then there is a hypermultiplet which is called universal because it contains the string coupling, the dilaton. So in the type 2B string basis, this hypermultiplet contains from the Nevesworth sector the dilaton and the two-form Nevesworth field, which is in four dimensions dualized to an axion, which I will call A. And then from the Ramon-Ramon sector, it contains an additional scalar and a two-form semi-nu, which can dualize to a complex scalar C. It was noticed that in perturbation theory, from the past in perturbation theory, there are three isometries which correspond to the three shifts, the axion shifts and the two Ramon-Ramon scalars. And these three shifts form a Heisenberg group, Heisenberg algebra, which is of this type. Okay, T1, T2 correspond to the two shifts of the Ramon-Ramon scalar, complex scalar, and the TA is the shift of the axion. Now, this algebra actually is extended by a fourth generator, which is just a rotation of these two generators. And if you want, this transformation corresponds to a phase rotation of the complex scalar of the Ramon-Ramon scalar. This is an additional perturbative symmetry. So at the end, you have four isometries, which can be recast in a form that describe a group which is a central extension of the two-dimensional Euclidean group. So you take the two-dimensional Euclidean group that contains the two shifts of the Ramon-Ramon scalars and the rotation, and then this axion shift is a central extension of the algebra of the E2. So that's what happens in the local case before the string compactifications. So you can do the following exercise. First of all, at the level of the local supersymmetry, one can, it was determined in the past, the effective action was determined in the past just using these isometries. So if you take just one, this universal hypermultiplet, then n equal to local supersymmetry implies that you should have a four-dimensional, one dimension, if you want, quaternionic manifold for scalar fields, which is equivalent to have a Weyl cell dual Einstein space of non-zero curvature. Then by imposing Heisenberg isometry, then one can show that this manifold is described, the kinetic terms is described in terms of a potential of one variable rho, which is associated to the dilaton. And this potential has just two possible terms, which are allowed by the isometry. The first one corresponds to the three-level effective axiom. That actually, if you take only this one, then this isometer is the four isometers become eight, and you have as U2 over U2 manifold. And the second term describes the one-loop correction, which is proportional to the sky, which is proportional to the Euler number of the Calabi-Yau manifold. And okay, in terms of this function, that's the metric. So rho squared is related to the dilaton in this way, where chi is the Euler number. And then C1, C2 are the two Lamora-1 fields. And A is the axiom. Okay, so you can write it in this way. I mean, all this is coming out from the from this potential. This was known before. Now, what you can do is you can repeat the same exercise in the global case. So suppose you take the global limit, the decoupling limit of this effective theory, and you want to preserve the isometries. So you ask what is, you should have, now instead of having a quaternionic manifold, you have a hyperkeller manifold with one hypermultiplet, so four-dimensional, which in this case should be, with respect to a Riemann tensor, a self-dual Einstein space of zero curvature, while here it goes non-zero, because the Planck mass goes to infinity. Now, when you impose that this manifold has also a Heisenberg isometry, then again you find that there is an effective potential of one variable, which I can write it like this, L plus I over 2, square root of 2 phi plus phi bar, where these are in the representation of the single tensor multiple that I described before, in order to describe the hypermultiple. And the relative the associated function, potential, if you want, out of which you can, which satisfies the Laplace equation that I wrote before. Where is it? Yeah, this one. Must have this form. So there are just two possible allowed terms. The surprising thing is that it allow, in the beginning we expect to find the flat space as a limit. No? In principle one finds that there is an additional possible term which is interacting, non-trivial, which is cubic in the potential. So if A is, if this is non-zero, then the B can be absorbed into V by translation, by shift. But if A is zero, then this is the usual free kinetic term. So actually what one can do is to define a zero curvature limit starting from the local case and going to the global case by taking therefore the Newton kappa to distinguish with the kappa that we were using before is the Newton constant to zero by scaling appropriately all the fields and it turns out that the dilaton has to be rescaled around a fixed constant value. First of all, what is the kinetic term that you find from the global for the global case? The metric is given here. So this is of the form of the Gibbon-Hawkins matrix. So it has this factor. A and B are the two parameters which appear in the in this potential. And you can define the limit from the local case to the global by taking this, you take any field, you rescale it with the appropriate power of kappa, but the dilaton has to be expanded around the constant value, which is twice the Euler number. So the string coupling corresponds to one of the two Euler number, and strictly speaking, therefore, this is valid when the Euler number is large. And it requires positive Euler number for this. I guess the reason could be that this includes the possibility of choosing, of going to type 2a and choosing a theory that contains only a single hypermultiplet. So take a Calabi-Yau space with H2 1 equals 0. So you have only a single hypermultiplet, and you don't have vector multiplet. For instance, take, this can be done. This includes this case. I guess if you take more hypermultiplets, maybe the conditions are different, and they can allow to be to have negative Eulerian numbers. But, okay. So I finished even before. So that's a conclusion. So I discussed some aspects of nonlinear supersymmetry, which are using an effective field theory approach, which is quite powerful for studying two things. The first was the low energy supersymmetry breaking n equal 1. The point here was that the Volkov-Akulov action was not the most general one, and there was a method using superfields, either constraints or standard superfields, to find the Goldstino coupling to matter. And in particular, we found dimension 6 operators, which could give, which could have phenomenological consequences. Or a Goldstino coupling to the MSSM. And then the second part was using the n equal 1 nonlinear supersymmetry together with a linear in order to study more precisely aspects of brain dynamics. So thank you.
Is there a way to fix scalpel?
It depends how you break supersymmetry. I mean, I presented these examples in string theory. String theory, of course, is related to the tension to the tension of the brain. But otherwise, it's model dependent. It's related to the sector which breaks supersymmetry. Depends how you break. Of course, it's a parameter, phenomenological is a parameter that you can predict.
In string theory, it would be the string scale.
Yes, string theory would be the string scale if you break the supersymmetry with brains, as I mentioned. But these were just stoic examples. You can imagine to do dynamical breaking. Maybe the conclusion should be the same, that we didn't use how the supersymmetry was broken.
Any more questions? Okay, so thank you. Again.